Back in March 03, and this was, of course, before we even invaded Iraq, or right as we were invading Iraq, you wrote, "I strongly believe that going to war now will make the world more dangerous, not safer." You write, "The countries of the world supported America's actions in Afghanistan as a response to the September 11th Al-Qaeda attacks, but since then we have lost the incredible sympathy of most of the world because of our policy toward Iraq." You write, "Much of the world considers our statements about Iraq as arrogant, untruthful, and masking a hidden agenda. That leaders of moderate Muslim and Arab countries tell us about predictable outrage and anger of the youth of their countries if America enters an Arab country with the purpose of attacking Muslims and Arabs rather than defending them, and that attacking the Saddam regime in Iraq now is very different than expelling the same regime from Kuwait as we did 10 years ago." And I guess I want to ask you if you think your predictions came true. Do you think that the U.S. actions in Iraq has made the world more dangerous today and not safer?
Well, Mark, I certainly do. And it's terrible when you have to write about your government's actions and policies that you think that those were going to make the world more dangerous, not safer, and make America more a target than lessening that possibility. But I'll tell you, virtually everybody that had been in foreign service work, international relations, they knew in their heart what was going to happen. And my letter of resignation just kind of capsulized it all, and it's coming true, as everyone who knew a thing about the Middle East was predicting.
Now, it's interesting, as I remember back in 2003, and even going into December and January of 2004, it was the time of the Democratic nomination for presidency, and Howard Dean was running, and he said that he felt that the war in Iraq had made us less safe, that Saddam Hussein was a horrible dictator, as we all know, but that the situation in Iraq, we were less safe than we were now. And he was routinely attacked, not just by Republicans, but by Democrats as well, for going beyond the pale, saying, in fact, that removing Saddam Hussein had made us less safe. Do you think that, I guess two questions. One, you just said that you think people in the Foreign Service basically believed this but didn't speak up. Are you saying that, what, half, a majority? I mean, what were people telling you then? And then the second question is, do you think more people today are willing to say that kind of thing publicly?
Well, I would say that at least 75% of the people in the Foreign Service, and probably 50% of those in the U.S. military, particularly those whose jobs dealt with international relations, knew full well what was going to be happening. In the 3 days after I resigned from the Foreign Service, I received over 400 emails from Foreign Service colleagues from all over the world, as well, of course, those that were serving in the State Department. All of them, giving me great courage, to go ahead and speak out even further, because they acknowledged and underscored really what I was saying about. And these were people, many of them, that had much greater experience in the Middle East, in Middle Eastern affairs. But all of us who had been serving all over the world, representing America, and were getting an earful from all of the governments and citizens of those countries we were serving in about their great concern about the United States' policy, about the Bush administration's policies.
In fact, one of the things you say is that if we do a preemptive attack against Iraq, that will be used to provide justification for a preemptive attack against America and American citizens.
Yes, and it's a justification for doing lots of other things, too. For example, if you look at the types of human rights abuses that are going on all over the world, I mean, there are people that are countries there now that are, I would say actually that the United States is now replicating those human rights abuses that we were counseling and berating countries for their treatment of their own citizens. Well, we've started doing the same thing to ourselves, or to our own citizens, as well as to those that we pick up in countries all over the world, but particularly in Afghanistan and Iraq. So we have emulated the worst parts of regimes that we were counseling out.
Yeah, Colonel Wright, I definitely want to get into some of that. But before I do, I want to go back to your point when you said you felt that 75% or so of the Foreign Service agreed with you. They were afraid to speak up. What's interesting to me, of course, is your boss at that time was Secretary of State Colin Powell. And we know, at least from Bob Woodward's book, that Colin Powell was apparently at least shared your sentiment to the extent that he told President Bush, hey, if you go into Iraq, it's like Pottery Barn. If you break it, you bought it. So do you think that Secretary of State Powell shared your sentiments, and do you think he passed them on to the president?
Yes, I think he did. And I, and you know, the more you read of various meetings that were held back in 2002 and early 2003, Colin Powell was counseling both the president and the Secretary of Defense on a lot of different things. I mean, Powell was saying, you know, if we're going to war, you know, you've got to go in with overwhelming force, kind of the Powell doctrine of Gulf War One, that if you go to war, you by golly better get enough people in there so that you can win the war, get it done, get a security blanket on the place. Well, he was very concerned, as rightfully he should have been, and having been alerted by Secretary or the Army Chief of Staff, General Eric Shinseki, who had gone to the U.S. Congress back in the spring of 2002 to say the operations plans that were being put into effect by the Secretary of Defense were lacking by a couple of 100,000 troops in order to be able to do the job that they were being told to do, which was invade Iraq and put a security blanket on it so that you wouldn't have take out the remnants of the Iraqi military and not allow them to kind of fade into the woodwork, and also you could put a seal around the borders of Iraq so that fighters would not be coming in from all parts of the region, and particularly from Afghanistan.
And of course, when Shinseki said this, his boss who stuck up with him, the chief of the army, Secretary White, was fired for sticking up for Shinseki. I actually should make a correction from what I said yesterday. I said that Shinseki had talked about the cost being a certain amount. He had talked about the number of troops we need. The person who talked about the cost was Larry Lindsey, who felt it would cost $100 or $200 billion. In fact, now it's cost $300 billion.
Yes.
But he was fired at the time because of his extreme off-the-mark suggestions, with Paul Wolfowitz saying that it might cost $1 or $2 billion, plus we get it all back with Iraqi oil revenues. We now know, in fact, that Larry Lindsey had underestimated the cost of the war. Sure.
And again, I mean, Colin Powell, the most officers, I mean, having been the chief of chairman of the Joint Chiefs, having led the military in the biggest war that we've had since Vietnam and successfully led it, his advice being thrown out the window, essentially, and then his allowing himself to be used as the parrot for the bad intelligence, which he subsequently has acknowledged that the intelligence briefing that he gave to the UN Security Council was incorrect. And one could say, okay, he just was handed a bad sheaf of papers of this intelligence. And in fact, but he knew that it was bad because he made sure that Tenet, the head of the CIA, had to sit right behind him at the UN Security Council, so that at least for historical records, you could say that Tenet was there as the person who had provided him with all of that intelligence.
It's also important to point out that Powell knew, for example, that the forged documents in Niger that said that Saddam Hussein was trying to get aluminum tubes for nuclear weapons, he knew that was false. By the way, the president said that in the State of the Union speech, but Powell knew it was false and refused to include that in the UN documentation. But he included a lot of other things that Powell at the time didn't know was false. Such as things like tractor trailers.
There was a debate whether it was false, and he decided he would go with the people that said it was true. But there were people in the State Department, in the Department of Intelligence and Research, that were saying these things are not right. And he went ahead and chose the path of, okay, we'll go ahead and, you know, we'll go ahead and say some of these things. But it was not that it was 100% that the intelligence community of the United States of America was agreed on this stuff. And when you have your own intel office of the State Department saying to the secretary, you know, you have to be very careful about this stuff because we will not confirm this. That's where I have a bone to pick with Colin Powell. And to me, of the one person in our government that if he had stood up back in late 2002 and 2003 and said, Mr. President, I'm sorry, but I have to resign because I think we are first, the intelligence that we have is not, it's not confirmed. It's wishy-washy, and secondly, if you decide to go to war, you don't have the right operations plans, and therefore, I will resign before I will stand here and allow the military that I have served for 35 years and dearly love to go to war and get the hell beat out of it, which is exactly what's happening right now. The strongest military of the world is getting sucker punched in every way, because we never have put enough troops into Iraq. And that's saying if you even believe we ought to be in there. And I certainly do not believe we should have ever gone to war in that place. And I think the faster we get out of that, the better off everybody is. Because as long as there is one U.S. troop sitting in Iraq, you are going to have they're going to be the target. Yep. And it doesn't do any good for anyone.
Colonel Wright, I find what you say very interesting. I wonder whether you have any inkling of whether Colin Powell ever considered resigning at that time.
I have no inkling at all, but I would say that deep down in his heart, he had to be having grave second thoughts about this.
And I wonder. It's always interesting to hypothesize what could have happened. But if Colin Powell had resigned or threatened to resign, would that have stopped some of this march to war? I guess we could never know.
We can never know. But I'll tell you what, it is a lesson for all of us. I think where you put your loyalties, and for me, my loyalty is with my country, not a particular administration. And I really think deep in his heart that's where Colin Powell's loyalty has always been, with the country and not any particular administration. But when you get so tied up, and certainly, you know, being appointed as a political appointee to these offices, you decide you have a certain loyalty. Except that we have other examples. For example, Paul O'Neill.
Secretary. Actually,
I guess he was fired as Secretary of Treasury for
right.
for speaking up too much.
Christine Todd Whitman is another.
Yeah,
had the EPA. She spoke out a little bit too much. But I guess. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, there are long range consequences to all of these sorts of things, both with our country and both with the human consciousness. And one thing that I am so glad that I went ahead and worked with my conscience and did what my conscience was telling me to do is, you know, the ultimate karma of all these things. The karma on this one is really bad. And I think there are lots of people in their next lifetimes, if there are such things, that had better be watching out, because they ain't coming back as anything good. Because this thing stinks to high heaven.
Well, you know, and it brings to mind our new Secretary of State, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, because she was accused by the Democrats in the Senate of putting her loyalty to the president above the truth, above, in essence, her loyalty to America, because she was more concerned at parroting the president's line, they felt, than to doing the right thing for the country and to telling us the truth about the build-up to war in Iraq, what's going on there. I'm curious to know what you felt of her new designation as Secretary of State.
Well, I think everyone should be very watchful of her statements. I know the rest of the world will be watchful, and that they will be calling her hand on things that Americans will be, a lot of them may not, because you get called, being called a traitor, or being, you say, you're being called a liar when you question whether or not the things that she's been saying are truthful or not. I would say Americans have to be very, very watchful, because she is definitely a very loyal administration person. And I think in the past, the statements that she has made have been shown to be untruthful. And they are administration statements. They are not really what has turned out to be correct. So I think as a secretary, the one thing that the world looked at to Colin Powell, that once that intelligence thing was done, and he was kind of chagrined on that thing from the very beginning, at least in general, I think the world felt that they could trust a lot of the things he said. I'm not at all convinced that other countries of the world will be so convinced about Condoleezza Rice.
You know, Colonel Wright, it was interesting to me when you talked about the fact that a lot of people suggest that dissent is somehow un-American or unpatriotic. I get that on my blog or my website all the time, and it's certainly not limited to me. We heard it with some of John Kerry. We even had a Vietnam War veteran who lost two legs and an arm, Senator Max Cleland, have his face morph into Osama bin Laden for daring to oppose the administration's agenda of basically taking labor rights out of the Department of Homeland Security. I'm curious, when you resigned from the Foreign Service, did you get hate mail, charges of disloyalty, people not just disagreeing with you but actually accusing you of being un-American?
Oh, I think there were a couple of things that were posted on a few of the websites that had posted my letter of resignation, but in general, I mean, like 99.9% of the communications that I received were in support of what I'd done, that maybe they didn't agree with everything that I had put in my letter of resignation, because I had one of the longest letters of resignation in the history of the Foreign Service, but I figured I'd been a federal employee for 35 years, and I could at least write one page for every decade I'd served America. So I put in everything that I was concerned about, and of course not everybody fully agrees with every point of it, but the general message of it, not the majority, but like 99.9% of the people that communicated with me agreed with it. And as I've talked all over the country over the last year, and, you know, there is a certain amount of, you talk to the convinced that the people that come to hear what I have to say already kind of believe the way I do. I have not faced people yelling at me, you know, traitor, coward, all that sort of stuff, because I'll be glad to put up my credentials against anybody.
And
anybody that dares, not dares, I mean, because it's their right. Anybody that wants to go ahead and say those words about me, fine. But let's compare backgrounds. Let's compare where we've put our lives on the line. I've done that in Grenada and Somalia and Panama and Sierra Leone and Afghanistan. You know, I'll put my record up against anybody's. And with that, the way I look at it, it's the responsibility of every American citizen to look critically at what any administration tells us, and not just the Bush administration, but what
Absolutely.
The Clinton administration
Absolutely.
Told us. Yeah, you know, all the way around. And
Absolutely.
It's your responsibility. And dissent is patriotic. I
Absolutely.
Mean, you need to be able to know the issues well enough that you can pick them apart. And if a government cannot stand the heat of the eyes of America looking on them, and they start calling you a traitor or saying that you're a liar for even questioning them, then that shows a little bit of insecurity and unconfidence and perhaps obscurement of what the truth really is.
Or perhaps they're trying to hide something that they're doing they don't want to get caught. As soon
yeah.
as dissent is no longer patriotic, we are no longer living in a democracy. We have to go to a commercial break. If you want to call in and ask Colonel Wright questions, she has a very long experience in the Army and in the Foreign Service. She has a lot of insight into what's going on. All you have to do is dial toll-free 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. We'll put you right through, and you can ask your question. And when we come back, I want to talk about the Iraqi elections. I want to talk about the state of Afghanistan and see what insights Colonel Wright can give us from her many years in the Foreign Service and in the military. We'll be right back after these messages.
Seems especially inappropriate. Public schools. All across the country, corporations are weaseling their brand names into young, impressionable minds by buying the naming rights to school facilities. A New Jersey elementary school gym is now named the ShopRite Supermarket Center. A Chicago area high school football stadium is now Rust Oleum Field. And the end zone of a high school football field in Plano, Texas, sports the bright, shiny logo of Krispy Kreme Donuts. Indeed, Plano School District has hired a full-time marketing director to hawk school properties to corporations that want to slap their ads on yet another space. There's even a marketing director for the National Federation of State High School Associations, and she's positively exuberant about this corporatization of public schools and school kids. Corporate involvement at the high school level is about to explode nationwide, she gushes. It's an unlimited, untapped market, and it's in places companies often can't easily reach. Great. School kids are no longer students, but a market. And our own public officials are throwing open the schoolhouse door so companies can reach into their little heads. I understand it's a slippery slope, says a New Jersey superintendent, but we need the revenue. Oh, well, then it's okay, right? Another marketer says, commercialism is coming to a school near you. The high school cheerleaders will be brought to you by Gatorade, and the football team will be presented by Outback. This is Jim Hightower saying, if you think school ought to be for education, not corporations, call Commercial Alert, 503-235-8012.
If you've been thinking about consolidating your federal student loans, it's time to call College Loan Corporation at 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will explain the benefits of the consolidation program, including locking in the lowest rate in history, reducing your current monthly payment by up to 58%, and cutting down multiple payments into one simple check. For more information, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
1 in 4 adults has high blood pressure. If your cold medicines can raise your blood pressure, Free HBP provides a line of safe, powerful cold and flu medications specially formulated for people with high blood pressure. So make the safe choice. Coracidin HBP. Use as directed.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine, bringing you all the news from Washington the government does not want you to know. Here with the highest ranking person ever on the Inside Scoop. Her name is Colonel Ann Wright. She served in the Army for 26 years and the Foreign Service for another 16 years until she resigned in 2003 to protest the Bush policies. If you want to call in and ask Colonel Wright your questions, feel free to do so. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and Colonel Wright.
Yes, this is Gordon from Michigan.
Hey, Gordon, how are you?
All right. I wonder if the colonel can see a scenario in Iraq where escalation and not phasing out of U.S. troops would be the order of the...
More troops in to do snuff out. The forces of Iraq that are against Americans being in there to start with, and you're never going to force, and what you're going to do is being escalating the numbers of young men and women of the Middle East in particular, and also now of Southeast Asia, Muslim fighters who are saying Americans do not, should any Americans that have invaded Middle Eastern a Muslim country have to.
Think about the possible disintegration of order after these elections, if it really is a worst case scenario, wouldn't that be a perfect excuse to pour more troops in?
Sure. I mean, you don't need an excuse to put more troops in. I mean, one of the political or the military theories is that there should have been a heck of a lot more, at least 200,000 more in there in the very beginning. I think now, though, it is probably unsalvageable by military force. I think eventually it will be a political settlement with the United States, and the only way to get to a political settlement that essentially U.S. forces are going to have to leave. And then if the whatever Iraqi government that is in power requests that a true international, not just the U.S. coalition of the willing, but a true international military force to help kind of stabilize the security situation, if indeed the persons of the former military and these foreign fighters, if they see that force as being a non-American force and amenable to an Arab nation taking over its own affairs, then you may have a chance that place might settle down. But tragically, in my opinion, there are going to be a lot more Iraqis that are killed by those forces, as well as killing hundreds of Iraqis every single day. And the families of those Iraqis will, of course, and the families of those Iraqis will, of course, and as a result, our guys and gals, you might as well just put a big old bullseye on them because they are the targets of an ever-growing union.
Does that answer your question, Gordon?
Yes, it does. Is the colonel a Marine by any chance?
No, sir. I'm was with the U.S. Army.
Special operations. Okay. Thank you. Iraqi government comes into power, and of course, it's coming in by this convoluted method. I think Americans are under the mistaken impression that there's going to be an election for Iraqi president. What happens if there is an Iraqi government and they ask us to leave? The elected government asks us to leave, or do you think the Bush administration can? I don't want to use the word fix, but let's just say use election procedures in a way to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Well, of course, the pressure that can be put on Iraqi oil entities, the Bush administration could tie, and in fact, the Bush administration at some point may be looking for an excuse to leave. And if the duly elected or duly appointed administration could tie, and in fact, the Bush administration at some point may be looking for an excuse to leave. And if the duly elected or duly appointed or anybody finally says, you, the Americans, you have to get out, and the Bush administration, if it's of a level that the Bush administration can say, well, look, here now, here's the government. They're now willing to take on the responsibility of their own security that we've been asked to leave, and yes, we will leave. Well, that would be one out. But I don't think the Bush administration will be so fast to leave because, you know, we are creating or have created the 14 military bases in Iraq, and it bases whether they will be bases from which to operate into Iran, whether it would be bases to operate into Syria. Both now you will be the lightning rod for all Islamic fighters all over the world, and our country will never get back to peace while you are here.
Colonel,
so
right,
area of oil is in charge. But when you look at the amount of money that has been put forward by the U.S. government for the redoing of various pipelines, constructing other pipelines, fixing up various parts of the oil industry there, it's interesting. It will be interesting to see who really does, where that money is going to go that comes out of those oil fields. Right now, my understanding is that the oil workers, some of them, there's a labor union in Iraq. And, you know, some of the things that we don't realize about Iraq was that it was, even though Saddam had kind of kept a thumb on certain aspects of life there, the political life, the economic life had, there were, women had all sorts of jobs in Iraq.
Far more than Saudi Arabia, certainly.
Oh, absolutely. And the oil workers had labor unions. Anyway, there's a labor union that's on strike in the oil fields because of the what they feel is the inordinate control of the oil and oil production, I think, by the American advisors now to the Ministry of Oil.
Interesting. So we've got some more callers on the line. I want to get to them.
Mm-hmm.
But you raised some very interesting points. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and Colonel Wright.
This is Ed from New York, and I'd like to ask Colonel Wright something. Colonel, it occurs to me that when you resigned because of the fact that you were upset with American policy. And I wonder, what do you think people who have opinions like yours, are they still willing to stay in the government and outlast the Bush administration, or are they being inclined to resign, and are they being replaced with ideologues?
Great question. Colonel mm-hmm. Wright?
Well, there were only three of us from the diplomatic corps from the State Department that resigned in opposition to the war in Iraq. So all those other people that I mentioned earlier in my conversation have stayed with the State Department. Seven different presidents, and in the 35 years that I was with the federal government. And I'll tell you that there were policies for every administration that I personally didn't agree with. There were some policies with every administration, and you just kind of moved yourself away from those policies and tried to work on things that you felt were good for America and that you could, in all good conscience, work for, and hope that you weren't really stained by the things that you personally didn't agree with. And I think that's the way things are happening right now in the government, that the long-term federal bureaucrats in the State Department and in the Department of Defense they kind of have to wait these things out. And sometimes you're a part of it, you're working with an administration that's elected by the people of America that are doing things that you personally don't agree with, but you try within the system to moderate those policies you don't agree with. But there are times that, you know, you get slam dunked on them. And so you have to hold your nose and go on and do something else that you hope is benefiting America.
Thank you very much for your call, Ed. I'll tell you, Colonel Wright, I remember when Richard Clark was testifying and talking about all the times he'd be the alarmist and say, the administration, you have to worry about Al-Qaeda, you have to worry about Al-Qaeda, no one was listening to him. And when he was giving this testimony before the 9/11 Commission, a number of Republicans complained that he didn't resign. Well, if the threat was so huge, why didn't you resign? And Richard Clark had to explain, well, that there's a trade-off. When you resign, you do make public your disagreements with the administration, but you can no longer work behind the scenes in a way. And so I definitely see that difficulty there. I guess Ed's question is, do you think that people are more today likely to salute and be loyal because of this administration, or do you think that it's pretty much the same as it's been for the last 6-7 administrations?
Well, I think there is, with all of the security aspects of which that all of the work that you do for them is in a venue where if people want to check on it, they can kind of do it. Well, that in a way has created a situation where the people are really less likely to write of the who's watching, who's talking about what.
Interesting.
That said, the numbers of people I think that are working in the federal government right now who are very, very concerned about the outcome of this policy on Iraq and some of the other policies are very, very great. They are there and they're going to hang in. But it doesn't mean that just because not everyone has resigned means.
As I connect all this, there is nothing whatsoever noble about our involvement. Yeah, right.
And the other thing that's interesting, of course, as you, Dave, know, and most of our listeners probably know, because if they listen to me enough, they know this, but what Paul O'Neill brought out in his book, that in January 30th, 2001, 10 days after Bush became president, he'd already developed a plan to divide Iraq into more than a dozen oil fields for various companies. But go ahead. I've interrupted
you.
Ask your question.
If I'm hearing you correctly, Colonel Wright, when we did invade Iraq, we headed straight for – we did not take them on in a military basis. We headed for the oil fields, and that's what we're holding right now. Is that correct?
Well, that's right. The first things that were protected were the oil fields. They were grabbed and protected, and then later on, going after the cities but with not enough troops that you could even protect the cities, protect the the infrastructure there that we now as American taxpayers are paying for.
No, indeed, we left several hundred ton of high explosives unguarded that we were informed were there, but they couldn't spare soldiers to go move them or guard them, and that was outrageous.
Yes, indeed, and those are the same weapons in great measure that are killing Americans right now, anybody get into them. I mean, the whole issue of military order on how you run a military operation was lacking in this. I mean, the big holes in the military days.
There are some very greedy high-level special interests pulling the strings on everything to do with our government right now. It's going to be real tough time for the next few years.
Well, Dave, that's why we have this show. Thanks very much for your call. I always appreciate
it. I'm a big fan here.
I always appreciate when you call in. We have to take a commercial break. When we come back, Colonel Wright, there's still a lot of things to discuss. I want to know, sort of in response to Dave's question, why it is that even for those of us who didn't support the war in Iraq, why is it that once we went forward, we did it so badly? I want to see if you can answer that question. It's a tough one. And then I want to move on and talk about two more things. One, about how overstretched our military is, and whether that in Afghanistan is Al-Qaeda on the rise again. You were there for 6 months. Give us your insight into that. There's a lot to come up right here after these messages. All you have to do is call in 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. We'll be right back after this.
Good game, Mike.
Thanks. Hey, by the way, how was the doctor the other day?
Good, but my cholesterol's 200. It's a little high.
Yeah, I'm around 760.
760? You're kidding me.
Pretty impressive, huh?
No, not impressive. Not impressive at all. What are you on, some sort of butter diet?
Yeah, you know, I figured at 760, getting a loan on the new car should be no problem.
Loan? What are you talking about, man? You're not going to live long enough to pay back a loan.
There's credit score, and you'll learn how your credit up toward healthy credit. And a score of 760 is pretty healthy. So check out ScorePower at Equifax.com or call 1-877-4-EQUIFAX. That's EQUIFAX. Equifax.
Yeah, I figure I can get up to around 790 by the end of the year, you know, if I'm lucky.
Look, a little advice.
Yeah?
Eat a vegetable, a smoothie, something, man.
Get the power. ScorePower at Equifax.com.
Your dog eats your new sofa. Pet satisfaction rating 3%. Your hairdresser doesn't know burnt auburn from burnt toast. Hair color satisfaction rating 5%. After years of marriage, your husband still leaves the seat up. Spouse satisfaction rating minus 2%. Your car insurance comes in fairly. Car insurance satisfaction rating 97%. Geico.
Geico's customer satisfaction stands at 97%. How would you rate your car insurance company? Geico. 1-800-947-AUTO.
It's night. You have heartburn. You want fast relief. Zantac works fast. When first used, Prilosec OTC works not so fast. Zantac works right when you need it.
Hello. Relief.
Prilosec's label says it may take, especially at night. Use as directed.
I have these nightmares. This taco, not just an ordinary taco, but this big evil taco is haunting me.
Guacamole.
You see, I was exposed to credit cards in college, and I wasn't the most responsible person back then.
Go, go, go!
I mean, I heard the words credit card and thought, hey, hey, free money! Plane ticket to spring break? Credit card. New skis? Credit card. I mean, I heard the words credit card and thought, hey, hey, free money! Plane ticket to spring break? Credit card. New skis? Credit card. 135 taco dinners? Bam! Credit card. But hey, it's not too late to do something about your credit. Get ScorePower from Equifax.com. ScorePower gives you your credit report, credit score, and it puts you on the road toward the credit you deserve for just $14.95. So, check out Equifax.com today and get that taco you ate 7 years ago out of your life.
Get ScorePower at Equifax.com or 1-877-4-EQUIFAX. That's EQUIFAX. Equifax.
Adios, taco.
Get the power. ScorePower.
It's on the war in Iraq, and I think you and I both felt it was a mistake to go in. Once we decided to go in, why do you think it is that we did things so poorly? You mentioned, for example, Dave mentioned we didn't find the explosives. You mentioned that we had all these holes in our policy. Why was it done so badly, do you think?
Well, because the civilian leadership of the Department of Defense overruled the uniform military leadership on how you go to war. It was Rumsfeld, Fife, Wolfowitz who told the U.S. military, to include General Shinseki, stuff it. We don't want your opinions on how to run this war. We know how to do it. Rumsfeld specifically said, I'm redoing the way the military does things, that we want to do it with less people. We've got high-tech things. We don't need to do it the way you guys say we need to do it. From Paul Wolfowitz and Douglas.
Cover Afghanistan. You know, when we were attacked on September 11th, 2001, and we found out very soon thereafter it was Al-Qaeda and they were based in Afghanistan, Americans rushed to find a map to find out where Afghanistan was. There was overwhelming public support for the war in Afghanistan. Every member of Congress save one voted for it. I certainly was enthusiastic about going in and getting those people that killed 3,000 Americans. I don't know anyone, in fact, that was not. But very soon thereafter, within a few months after we fought in Afghanistan, suddenly Iraq was brought up. And in fact, were you in Afghanistan at that time when we started to talk about Iraq, or was that after your tenure in Afghanistan?
No, it was while we were there. In fact, if you remember, here in about mid-December 2001, we needed to get our embassy reopened as the new interim administration with Hamid Karzai and all were coming from Bonn, Germany, from the Bonn conference, where the warlords and other political interests of Afghanistan all agreed on an interim administration. So very quickly, the State Department, once we knew that the Afghans were ready to go back in as a political entity, we wanted to get our embassy reopened. It had been closed for 12 years, and I flew to Washington to lobby to get on that team to go out there because, what a historic moment. I'd been in Afghanistan 30 years ago as a hippie traveling.
Really?
And traveling from London to Kathmandu overland. And anyway, I wanted to be a part of that team, and
sure.
And I was fortunate to get selected.
Of course, it was very risky, I'm sure. I mean,
oh, yeah.
Very dangerous.
You might as well put a bullseye on that embassy because we knew that Al-Qaeda would be ready to do something nasty there and what remnants of the Taliban. So, it is, and it's still very risky. I mean, I'm quite honestly surprised that embassy hadn't had a rocket hit it. Rockets fly over it about a couple of times a week because there are plenty of groups in Afghanistan that have never liked foreign presences. And, in fact, the international community has to be pretty quick about what they do in Afghanistan because the Afghans themselves do not like foreign presences there.
Well, let me ask you, when you were there in those first 6 months, did you heard talk about Iraq? Were people surprised to hear that kind of talk?
Well, as we were sitting in the bunker of the embassy in January of 2002, listening to the State of the Union message, George Bush's, first State of the Union message, and when he said, the United States, even though we're in Afghanistan, we are concerned about the actions of other countries, three other countries that we call the Axis of Evil, Iraq, Iran, North Korea. Well, those of us in the bunker of the embassy looked at each other and went, oh no, the focus has already gone off Afghanistan, and things will be moving in another direction pretty fast. And indeed, we could tell that the U.S. never put enough troops into Afghanistan to actually do what needed to be done there, to include sealing of the borders, to try to capture the al-Qaeda. Well, first, the administration chose not to blow up those al-Qaeda training camps immediately after September 11th, something that they should have just... On September 12th, we should have had cruise missiles blowing the hell out of those camps.
Now, that's interesting. Let me just reiterate that, because that's something that hasn't gotten a lot of press, but it's something I think very important to point out. Bush could have done what Clinton did. In fact, Bill Clinton, when al-Qaeda attacked our embassies in Tanzania and Kenya, sent cruise missiles and destroyed their training camps and, in fact, barely missed bin Laden by a few hours. But my understanding is George Bush did not want to send cruise missiles because that was something Clinton had done, and he wanted to do it another way. Is that correct? I mean, that's what I've heard.
I don't know if that's the rationale, but whatever the rationale was the lost opportunity to try to take out some people that were still there. My supposition is that you never would have gotten bin Laden there because, I mean, that guy's smart, and he would not have been in a place that we predictably would be looking for him, like his own training camps in Afghanistan. I think he was well into Pakistan probably a couple of weeks before September 11th happened. I mean, there's no way that he would have stayed in those camps knowing full well that one possible immediate retaliatory technique would have been using the cruise missiles. But we could have gotten some other folks that would have been in there, I think, that wouldn't have scurried on out as early as bin Laden.
Is it your view that we haven't finished the job in Afghanistan?
No, we haven't at all. I mean,
is Al-Qaeda still powerful there?
Al-Qaeda does whatever it wants to. Along the borders of Afghanistan, they are in and out through the Tora Bora area whenever they want to. The Taliban is coming back in.
Tora Bora. We still haven't. They're still in Tora Bora? I thought we destroyed Tora Bora.
They come back through there anytime they want to. We don't have permanent troops that stay up in those mountains. It's way too extreme to put troops up there for long periods of time. We do small operations at various times to see if we can catch whoever might be having come back through, but we don't leave troops up there, no. And nor do we, I mean, the whole issue of the Taliban. The Taliban, with the agreement of the United States government, the Pakistani military flew planes into Afghanistan and moved out probably at least 2,000 Taliban back into Pakistan. because the Pakistani intelligence agency was the, you know, the people behind the scenes working the Taliban. So you have Taliban that are coming back into Afghanistan.
So our great, wonderful ally, Musharraf, the dictator of Pakistan that George Bush is praising all the time, is actually helping facilitate Taliban movements back and forth between Afghanistan and Pakistan?
I would not say he personally is doing it, but there are elements within that military that he cannot control. And the fact that he still is in charge in Pakistan is truly a miracle.
And
a number of people in Afghanistan,
they're very nervous, in fact, because Pakistan clearly has nuclear weapons, far more than even Iran or North Korea. And
mm-hmm.
if Musharraf gets overthrown in a coup, and after all, he took power in a coup,
mm-hmm.
we're in real trouble then, aren't we?
I
mean, if a Taliban or Al-Qaeda agent takes that much more powerful country of Pakistan, America is in real danger, aren't we?
Well, yeah, and the number of attempts on his life, the number of people in Pakistan that are protecting large groups of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. I mean, the whole tribal area along the Afghan border is not controlled by the government of Pakistan.
Nor the government of Afghanistan. They don't control their whole country either.
It truly is the Wild West, and
you know, it's fascinating. I tell you, I have these debates with conservatives all the time. They're like, oh, yeah, Afghanistan's a democracy and we moved on to Iraq. And I'm like, we didn't finish the job in Afghanistan. They say, oh, that's all propaganda. That's all John Kerry talk and silly stuff like that. You're telling me that there are whole areas of Afghanistan and Pakistan that are unpatrolled by any friend. I mean, not by Pakistan,
sure.
Not by Afghanistan, not by us. Just Wild
mm-hmm.
West, Al-Qaeda-controlled areas still today.
Yeah. Absolutely. And if you look at things that are going on in Afghanistan right now, like an assassination attempt on one of the big warlords of the place, General Dostum, up in the north. I mean, that guy's got more firepower. He's got more money to buy more firepower because, of course, we paid him off to go fight the war for us. He, along with four other warlords, made a hell of a lot of money off the United States because they were the ones that did the work for us, so to speak. We put in CIA paramilitary and special forces guys to kind of help orchestrate it, but it was really the warlords and their gang, some of which would be riding horseback through the area, but they're the ones that went after the larger groups of the Taliban and not many Al-Qaeda were left, really, when we got there, but larger groups of the Taliban.
And they're not necessarily our permanent friends, are they?
No, Lord, no. They have been bought off by every country in the region and by us before. They go to the highest bidder, and they go from month to month. And so if somebody else wants to buy them off next month, that'll be fine. They've made their money for the last 3 years from America, but they're up for grabs. And if you look at even, you know, Hamid Karzai, I've met him numerous times, and I think he individually is the greatest hope for Afghanistan, but he's there on a thread and a prayer. He's the mayor of Kabul. He tries his best to exert a little bit of influence, you know, through policies for the rest of the country, but he really has no mechanism for enforcing them.
He really has no power outside the capital.
No.
Now, Colonel Wright, let me ask you this. I know we could definitely pacify, well, I don't know if we could definitely, but we could certainly have a better job at pacifying Afghanistan, Pakistan, these areas where there are Al-Qaeda remnants, Taliban remnants, if we had more troops in the area. But of course, we have 10 times the troops in Iraq that we have in Afghanistan. Do you think our military and our National Guard, our reserves, are overstretched?
Oh, definitely. They are stretched to the breaking point.
We just don't have enough troops?
Well, no, but, well, you really have to fight the right battles, and when you go to war, it better be for something really good and in the national interest. Well, to me, going into Afghanistan to try to get Al-Qaeda, the people that had attacked us, that was an appropriate thing, but we didn't use enough troops. We didn't do it smartly. We let Al-Qaeda essentially escape. And then the administration decided to focus on something that was not a threat to the United States, that being Iraq. And we have now blown our military, to me, is about on its knees. I mean, we've got active duty people that are now on their third tours in either Afghanistan or Iraq. We've got National Guard and Reserve people who are valiantly trying to be a force, but they well, I think they're doing surprisingly well, considering that they, you know, haven't been full-time military, but I myself was in the reserves for a long period of time, and I think, you know, you get good training and you've got good people in there. But we when you decide you're going to invade and occupy a territory as large as Iraq, that is a huge undertaking that we were not equipped for.
Particularly, I mean, without international support to back us up.
That's right. The past history of at least the last 15 years has been you try to get your friends and allies to help you out on
that. Yeah, 90% of the troops are ours. Let me ask you this. You were telling me before, we only have a few minutes left, that's why I'm rushing you along a little bit. You and I talked prior to the interview today. You were telling me about a Marine who was on the plane with you who'd served in Fallujah, and I know you wanted to talk about what he had to say.
Yeah, and particularly today when you know, I live here in Hawaii, and 27 of our Marines from Kaneohe Marine Base were killed yesterday in a helicopter accident, and four more Marines were killed in other operations. This young fellow was sitting next to me. He had sunglasses on. He was listening to his music. You could tell he didn't want to talk. So it's, you know, like a 10-hour flight out of Chicago, and I thought, well, I'm not talk to him. Well, later on, as we were just getting in, he took off his shades and everything and said, where are you coming from? He said, Iraq. Mm. Well, how long have you been there? A year. Where were you? Fallujah. I said,
wow.
Oh, my God. Tell me about it. And he you know, just very short, crisp sentences. Well, it's a mess. I said, well, were you there during all the fighting? He said, yep, I was. There's nothing left of it. It's rubble. I said, gosh, that's, you know, horrible. I know you've been through hell and back there. And he said, yep, we're still going through it. He said, I said, well, how about the injuries and all? He said, well, a lot of Marines killed, a lot of Iraqi kills. He said, a lot of people are still getting sick in Fallujah just from the atmosphere around there. He said, the rubble, the dust, and what he didn't say, but I would add this in, the possibility of depleted uranium from all the shells that were used in there. He said that any time there's a cut on your body, he said more Marines have been medically evacuated because of infections from all of this grunge in the air and the, you know, the sewer, no sewers are working, so it's all out on the streets. He was just so sad to hear him. And then he said, yeah, and, you know, a lot of the guys are having mental problems. And
like post-traumatic stress disorder?
Yes, that's exactly right. And I said, well, what, you know, have you heard, are these people getting good help once they get back to the States? And he said, well, a lot of people don't actually, you know, say that they're having trouble with it because that ends, you know, that doesn't look good as a Marine to be doing it.
You never want to admit weakness, I guess.
Yeah. So, but he said, yeah, there are a lot of people that aren't able to handle what we've had to do. And then right here in Hawaii, I mean, we've got a lot of people that are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and the pressures on Tripler Army Hospital and then the Veterans Hospital here are tremendous. There are a lot of families that are coming forward to say we can't handle the way our service member parent is acting now because, you know, just the horrors of war and the classic post-traumatic stress syndrome. Yeah.
Colonel Wright, we only have a minute left. This hour flew by talking with you. I swear it's very easy. You give so many very interesting facts and information. In the last 30 seconds or so, do you have a final word that you want to get across?
Yeah, I sure do. First, don't be intimidated. Tell the truth. Require your public servants to tell the truth. And also, when you're looking at security at the airport, we'll always have that. We'll always have to have it because as long as we have the same U.S. policies, people are fighting us against our policies. And until our policies change on the Middle East, and until we get Americans out of the Middle East as occupiers of a Muslim Arab country, we will always be having people fighting against us. So force your political leadership to change these policies.
Colonel Wright, thank you very much for coming. I tell you, I said the same thing yesterday. I said that when will we learn that winning a war is not about taking territory, it's about winning the hearts and minds of the people there. Thank you very much for coming here.
Mark.
I definitely want you again some point in the future. You were a terrific guest.
Be my pleasure.
Thanks again for coming on the Inside Scoop.